Welcome, everyone. This is the fifth office hours session for the Mises Academy class, Mises on Money and Banking. This is the first quarter of 2012. And as always with these office hours sessions, we'll turn it over to the people who are tuned in live. So go ahead and post your questions in the main chat box, not the Q&A one. While you guys are thinking of your deep thoughts, let me just remind people, because we pushed the lecture 5 2 days back, I'm a little bit behind in getting the quiz up, so I'll do that. It's written now, but I have to go program it in to the Moodle software, so I'll do that after this office hour session, and then I'll send out an email blast, and you'll have an extra 2 days or whatever to do it, because that's my fault that you didn't get it in time. And then next week, we're back on the regular schedule. Yeah, so next week, March 7th, we will have the regularly scheduled lecture 6. And your quiz will be normal, so there'll be a couple days there where the two quizzes will be active at the same time. Okay, you guys got any questions? Well, you guys are still thinking, apparently. Let me say, I'm going to write a Mises Daily on, I want to explore this idea that Mises has now hit on twice in our readings. So the example he was using was the Austrian Gulden. I hope I'm pronouncing that within the same zip code of how it's supposed to be pronounced. Where there was the notes that were issued by the Austro-Hungarian bank that were, I think, immediately redeemable in silver, like in the 1870s maybe, and then at some point they suspended redemption, and Mises' point is that those things had higher, more purchasing power than bonds issued by the same government institutions, even if the bonds had the same nominal market value. And that's a very interesting thing. And if you've been reading all of the assigned pages, you'll see that Mises circled back to that same example. He gave more of the history of it. All right, so he touched on it once, and I had it in a PowerPoint slide, I think from week 4. But then in the reading for week 5, I believe, he circles back and talks about that same thing again and gives more of the details about what those notes were redeemable in and then what the bonds would have been redeemable in once the government went back on the precious metals standard. So anyway, I'm going to write a Mises.org on that, and I think just to give you an idea of where I'm going with it, because that's a very subtle issue to talk about the purchasing power of two assets being different even if they have the same nominal market value. At first that sounds like a contradiction, because that's what I was trying to do, just so you know, that you pull back the curtain of where do these Mises dailies come from. When I was trying to make sense of Mises as an example for me to tell you guys during the lecture this 2 weeks ago when I talked about it, I wanted to, because it's hard with us, first of all, he's talking about Austria and Hungary and the central bank over there, and there's silver going on and gold, and you don't know what the heck, you know what I mean? It's really hard with us not being there and knowing the culture and everything and the business practices to even get what the context is for Mises' statement. So I was trying to relate it to our time, and I was thinking, okay, like, what if there is a $100 bill, you know, the so-called Benjamin, right, a Federal Reserve note, a green piece of paper with a picture of Benjamin Franklin and the number 100 written on it with a dollar bill sign in front of it, or there is a bond issued by the U.S. Treasury that has a face value higher than 100, but that given the prevailing market interest rate on that particular maturity bond, that right now the spot market price of that thing is $100 exactly. And so you might be tempted to say, oh, well, those are two equivalent assets. They're both worth $100. You know, the $100 bill clearly is worth $100. And then you say, well, how much is that bond worth? And you say, oh, well, it's got a face value of whatever, $105, payable, whatever, 3 years out. But given the current market interest rate on that thing that's payable in 3 years, right now the price of that is $100. So if you were going to go into the bond market and auction that thing off, you would get, someone would pay you $100 for it right now. So from that analysis, you might be tempted to say, okay, so then someone says, okay, so which of those two things has a higher purchasing power? You might be tempted to say, well, they're the same. You know, it's kind of like saying, what weighs more, 100 pounds or 100 kilograms of hammers or 100 kilograms or 100 pounds of feathers? And the joke is, of course, they're the same. It just, you think that the hammers are going to weigh more because the hammer is real heavy and a feather's not. But if you're setting up the problem to be 100 pounds of one versus 100 pounds of the other, then they're the same weight. But that's not actually true with the bond versus the dollars. And I think I probably mentioned this before, but just to finish this train of thought, and then I'll get, I see Steve has a question posted. Because imagine you're selling your car, and someone comes up, and you've got two buyers, and one of them says, here, I'll give you $5,000 cash for your car. And he either means he's going to write you a check, or he literally has it in green pieces of paper. I guess the guy's a drug dealer or something. He's got that kind of cash on him. And the other person tries to give you a bunch of U.S. treasuries that he says, oh, go call your accountant or go look online, look at these things in the maturity, and with the interest rates as of right now, these are worth exactly $5,000. Which would you take? You would clearly take the guy who's going to write you a check, as long as you didn't think the check was going to bounce, or the guy who's going to give you the cash, again, assuming you weren't worried that it was drug money or something, or that you were going to get in trouble for having such a big cash payout, right? So you think through, and why is that? And it's obvious, because unless you happen to want to, unless you were going to take the proceeds from your car sale and go turn around and put it into U.S. treasuries of the exact maturities that other prospective buyer had in his possession, except for that one scenario, in which case you would be in, really wouldn't be there, then you would prefer the bonds. Any other scenario, you would strictly prefer the cash, because it would save you a step, right? Because if you get paid the bonds, and that's not the form that you want to hold your wealth in, you have to go sell the bonds for the $5,000, which by assumption they would fetch if you auctioned them off. All right? And so because of that, you actually would be willing to give a premium to someone who's giving you cash. Or going the other way, you would charge someone a penalty if they were trying to buy your car with bonds instead of with money. And so, you know, someone who wants to pay you in U.S. Treasury bonds that have a 3-year maturity on them, you might say, well, I'll sell you that, you know, you have to give me $5,500 worth of bonds, whereas someone who's willing to pay me literally cash, I'll sell to you for $5,000. And so that's the sense in which the purchasing power of $1 worth of currency is higher than the purchasing power of $1 worth of a bond. And so it's a very odd thing, because you're thinking, when you're quoting it in dollar terms, that's keeping everything constant, but it's not. So anyway, I think I'm going to write up an article on that issue in case that was tripping you up. I'll try to spell it out more carefully. But that's, I think it's useful to think through things like that when we're going through the theory of money and credit, because that's really an important observation or insight when you're really thinking through what is it about money. And it's and so in that particular case, you say, well, why is that? And so Mises, remember what Mises was saying is, you can't explain it. You can't explain the preference of the car seller, in my example, to accept the Federal Reserve notes. You can't say it's because, oh, well, right now maybe it's really credit money, and the people, the car seller thinks that at some point Ron Paul's going to win or Rand Paul's going to be in there and tie the dollar back to gold. And so the reason they're valuing these green pieces of paper with pictures of Benjamin Franklin on them is because they think at some point down the road they're going to be linked back to gold. And the way we explain the price of gold and the value of gold is that it's simultaneously used as an industrial commodity. And so ultimately we explain the purchasing power of all money, whether it's fiat or commodity, by, well, they wouldn't call it fiat, they would say it was credit money, by reference to the fact that it's exchangeable legally for the actual commodity, and then you explain commodity money by the fact that it's simultaneously being used for other things. So Mises' point, remember, is no, that is totally wrong. You're totally dodging the whole problem for monetary theory. The problem we have to explain is why is money valued as money? And so the reason, so that's wrong. So to knock that potential hypothesis out, Mises is going to say there's no way the car seller can't be taking the $5,000 in currency because he thinks at some point the dollar might be linked back to gold, because then he should, if that's his motivation, well then clearly he should take those U.S. bonds because those things are denominated in dollars. So if dollars ultimately are going to be linked back to gold, well that consideration affects your valuation of the bonds too, right? Because the bonds are going to pay you U.S. dollars. That's what the bond is. It's issued by the federal government. It's a promise to pay you dollars. So that should make the bond valuable too, the fact that it's going to ultimately give you things that you can turn in for ounces of gold. And on top of that, you're earning an interest return. So if you think the dollar is going to be linked back to gold a year out, and that's why, or you know, or you assign some probability to that, and you say, oh, there's another probability that within 2 years, within 3 years, and you have like higher and higher probabilities the longer you're willing to extend that window. And then you come up with your calculations as to the current value you give to that Federal Reserve note, which doesn't entitle you to gold right now, but you think it might at some point in the future. Whatever your subjective probabilities are for those possible events, Mises is saying this bond is going to give you strictly more dollars at all those future times. Right now they're the same. Right now the Federal Reserve notes give you $5,000, and the bond, if you were to auction it off, would give you $5,000. But once we start the clock and let time elapse, the bond gives you strictly more dollars because it's appreciating it with interest, whereas the Federal Reserve notes aren't. They're just sitting there. So that's what Mises' argument is, that if you as an economist and a theorist of money are trying to explain the valuation of money solely by saying, well, even if right now it's not redeemable for precious metals, people think that it might be at some point in the future, and that's the way they're valuing it. He's just saying, no, that doesn't make any sense. If that were true, then bonds issued by the government should always, you know, adjusting for the same nominal market value at the time you're making the consideration, they should always, people should always prefer those to having the money, but they don't. And so why is that? Well, it's for the reason we just said, or we said 10 minutes ago when I started, that the community uses Federal Reserve notes as money, as a common medium of exchange. They do not use U.S. treasuries as a common medium of exchange. Treasuries are very liquid, but they're not as liquid as money. And so because of that, that's why people would be willing to sell the car for a lower number of Federal Reserve notes denominated in dollars than they would for U.S. treasuries measured in terms of how many dollars would they fetch if you auctioned them off, because the Federal Reserve notes are the money. And so once you get that, I mean, it's a very simple point, but yet it's profound. So that's what Mises is trying to do. He's trying to get you to see, we as economists need to explain that. How can it be that people value something because it's useful as a medium of exchange, and how do we make sure we don't just walk in a circle? Because we don't want to merely say people value money because it's money. Because that by itself isn't a very good explanation. And remember, that was the stumbling block traditionally to people who tried to use the Mengerian subjective value marginal utility approach with money, as they thought, oh, wait a minute, you can't just explain the purchasing power of money by reference to its purchasing power. You know, so that's why the theorists who are trying to go outside and say, oh, well, the reason people value gold coins, you know, how we can explain that is we say, oh, because the gold is also being used simultaneously in industrial applications. Partly probably why they thought that they should go that route was because then they weren't going in a circle. They were explaining one thing by reference to something different, where they thought it looks like we're just going in a big circle if we try to just directly tackle how is it that money, qua money, is valued, since its value derives entirely from its ability, its objective exchange value. And so that is what Mises is trying to tackle. So he's saying we don't need to run away from that. That is the problem. And here I'll show you, using what we now call the regression theorem, how we explain that without going in a big circle and how we avoid an infinite regress. All right, so I took 15 minutes there, but again, this is one of the central things of the first half of the book, so I wanted to keep hitting that point. Okay, so as always, just to remind you guys, feel free to post your questions, even if I haven't wrapped up the answer to an earlier one, so I know how to pace myself. Steve Chipman says, if inflation is defined as an expansion of the money supply beyond the existing demand for money, do we currently have inflation? It seems that currently there is a large demand for money due to economic uncertainty. Okay, really good question. Steve, I'm curious. Are you doing the reading for, is that from week six? I'm about halfway through the material for week six myself. I mean, what you're talking about is not, we haven't hit that part of the book yet in terms of up through week five. But anyway, it at some point in the theory of money and credit, Mises does have a, he talks about inflation versus deflation and then has an appendix where he defines the terms. And I'm assuming that's what Steve Chipman is alluding to here. And Mises says something like, if we as technical economists want to give a precise definition to the terms inflation or deflation, the only coherent way to proceed is to say that inflation occurs when the supply of money increases faster than the demand for money, leading to a fall in its purchasing power. And on the other hand, deflation must refer to the situation where the supply of money either falls or does not grow as quickly as the demand for money, leading to a rise in the purchasing power of one unit of money. So, and when we hit that part, I'll talk a lot more about that, because that is a lightning rod for the modern Austrian arguments over free banking. Right, so in the lecture, right, or not the lecture, in the offhand remarks right now, I'm not going to get into that, but I'm just letting people know the reason that's a hot button passage from this book is that guys like Murray Rothbard and Joe Salerno and Guido Holtzman and Hans Hoppe want to say that any increase in the quantity of money that's not backed up by an increase in specie, so in other words, whenever banks issue fiduciary media, that will set in motion the so-called Austrian business cycle. And people like Steve Horowitz and I think George Selgin and Larry White, though I'm not as confident about them, but for sure Horowitz, are going to say, no, you only get the Austrian business, so you only get the unsustainable boom if the quantity of, if banks issue money in excess of the community's demand to hold money. So if the community all of a sudden wants to hold more money, and if the banks just didn't do anything that would lead to a fall in prices, Horowitz and those guys, I think they want to say, it's fine if private banks, you know, there's no Fed or anything, but it's purely free market, but banks in their mind can have fiduciary fractional reserves, and if they want to accommodate that sudden demand to hold more money by issuing more fiduciary media so that the stock of money rises and that stops up the increased demand so that prices don't have to fall, then that's fine. That's not going to cause a boom-bust cycle, those guys would say. And to the two camps, in part of their argument, they want to go back to Mises and say, well, what does Mises think? And there's lots of passages in the theory of money and credit where Mises says fiduciary, the issuing of fiduciary media contains the seeds of its own destruction. He says that in one spot. So there's plenty of places where, like, Joe Salerno could point and say, see, Mises isn't saying over and above the demand to hold the money. He's saying fractional reserve banking per se sets in motion the unsustainable boom. End of story. Rothbard's right. You guys are wrong. But then those guys can come back, Horowitz and those guys, and they point to this definition that Mises gives of what inflation and deflation are. And so they can say, no, see, Mises is saying here that inflation, the very definition of it, only means if the quantity of money grows or the supply of money grows more quickly than demand. So if you're just offsetting or accommodating an increase in the public's demand to hold money, Mises would say that's not inflationary. So how can you have an inflationary boom if Mises is saying there's no inflation? So that's the issue. So I won't resolve that. But just now to go back to Steve Chipman's question, well, it depends what we mean by the money supply. Because people argue there's different things. Like there's the monetary base, which includes bank reserves. But then there's also a popular one is M1, which just means the currency in the hands of the public and checking account balances, like demand deposits. So part of what's going on with how come Bernanke apparently was doing all this crazy stuff and had a bunch of Austrians, including me, worried about massive price inflation, but yet, sure, gasoline is expensive, but it's not like it's $20 a gallon. So what's going on? Part of what's happening is Bernanke, yes, he did more than double the Fed's balance sheet in a short period of time there. And so he created a bunch of money out of thin air. But a lot of it is bottled up in the banking sector. So it's just sitting with the banks have over $1 trillion now in excess reserves, and they're not lending it out to the general public. So what you see is that the monetary base went way up, but M1 and M2, things like that, didn't go up nearly as much. They all went up, but they didn't go up nearly as much. Okay, so now back to your question. So Steve, part of the problem is, what do we pick as the correct definition of the money supply? So that's one issue. So to say if inflation is defined as an expansion of the money supply beyond the existing demand for money, well, the benefit of that then is we can test and see. So you're theoretically, we don't know. We can get a pretty good handle on what happens with the supply of money. We can just pick which one we mean. And actually, even there, let me just spend a few minutes, since this is a fairly technical class as these things go. There actually is a distinction between the supply of money and the quantity of money, or the stock of money. Right? So just forget money for a second, because that's too complicated. Just think of apples. If I tell you the supply of apples increases, strictly speaking, that doesn't mean there are more apples in existence, right? Because the supply means the whole curve moved to the right. So what that means is at any hypothetical price, apple producers are now willing to bring more apples to market compared to the old situation. So if the supply of apples goes way up, but the demand for apples goes way down, there might be fewer apples that are actually sold, right? And the price for apples would be way down. So let me just say that again. If I tell you, oh, wow, you know, in 2011, there was a certain supply of apples, and in 2012, because of really good weather, and there was some new techniques that, you know, the Monsanto scientists came up with these new things, and all the libertarians were horrified, but so what? They genetically modified the apples and the seeds, whatever, blah, 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 fertilizer, and the supply of apples doubled. Strictly speaking, we don't know what happened if the quantity of apples harvested in 2012 is going to be higher than in 2011. If when we said supply of apples, we were being precise, and we really meant supply as economists define the term. Because, to contain that example, maybe all the libertarian consumers are horrified that Monsanto was involved, and so everyone says, oh, don't eat any apples because now you're going to get a tumor or something. And so everybody stops buying apples. So even though, you know, if you were drawing a typical supply and demand chart, you could move that supply curve way to the right, but if the demand curve moved way to the left, it's possible. So for sure the price is going to go way down because that moves, you know, both of those things push down prices, other things equal. So the two of them together are going to push prices way down. But depending on which curve moved more, the quantity of apples produced in equilibrium can either go up or down. All right, so that's why just be careful. Now talking about money, when people say, oh, the supply of money went up, I think usually what they mean is the actual quantity of money that in existence, the number of units of money that exist is now higher than it used to be. I think that's what people usually mean. And so technically, it's not right to describe that situation as saying the supply of money went up. Because remember, the supply means the whole supply curve, if you're graphing, or the supply schedule, if you're looking at a table. And so it's admittedly weird because nowadays we tend to think of the government or the central bank determining that, whereas if we're under total, you know, commodity money system and a Rothbardian paradise, then the concept of the supply of money would make more sense. That you would, like, if it's gold, to say the supply of money went up would just mean in various possible exchange ratios of an ounce of gold for every other type of commodity out there, miners are willing to bring more gold to the marketplace. And then, you know, so that's the way you could figure it out. So anyway, back to your question, Steve. What you'd want to do then to see which effect is stronger is you'd want to see what happened to the price of money, to the purchasing power. So there's various things we can do. I mean, if you're going to look at commodities, well, then clearly Bernanke has been inflationary. The commodities are a lot more expensive now than they were since he started doing all his QE stuff. But if you just mean a basket of consumer goods, it's also the case, but it's not nearly as much. And then people get into first derivatives, and they'll say, you know, because that's the thing I was doing with people. They're saying, what are you guys talking about? You know, worried about massive deflation and all this stuff. I said, clearly the dollar has lower purchasing power now than it did in 2008, under any definition you want to use, except for home prices. You know, the only place where the dollar has gotten stronger is when it comes to residential real estate in certain markets. You know, I'd have to go look at the figures, but I think that's probably the case, that many homes are cheaper now than they were in 2008. So there you could say prices are falling, and so the dollar is gaining purchasing power, but on just about any other metric, it's the dollar is weaker now than it was, certainly against other currencies. So what some people do, though, is they say, oh, yeah, but I'm talking about the first derivative, meaning historically the dollar, at least since the 70s, the dollar has always lost purchasing power, but in the last few years that reduction has been far slower than it normally is, and so that's a disinflation. So it's not actually deflation, but it's a disinflation, they'd say. So, anyway, there you go. But anyway, Steve, I hope that long answer managed to answer your question, that I think under, regardless of what we pick as the relevant quantity of money, whether we're talking about the base or something different, the purchasing power of the dollar has gone down. So in that sense, even though there has been an increase in the demand to hold money, that has been more than offset by increases in the quantity of money. Okay, Connor O'Neill says, has Mises or any Austrian ever written on company towns like Pullman, Chicago, and whether or not it was a good thing that they issued their own currency and owned the whole town? What are your thoughts? I don't know of any Austrian take on that issue, and unfortunately, I don't know enough about it. I mean, I vaguely know what you're talking about, but I don't know enough about it, so sorry to say that. Okay, Lewis says, which definition of inflation do you find more analytically suitable for economic purposes, the Misesian or the Rothbardian one? All right, well, now you're forcing me to get more into that issue. So Rothbard in Man, Economy, and State, and presumably elsewhere, defines inflation as the increase in the money stock over and above the increase in the commodity money or specie or something like that. I forget his exact phrasing. So there are a couple of interesting implications of that. So one thing is, there, by definition then, there can't be inflation in a free market as Rothbard envisions it. Because in Rothbard's view, in a truly free market where property rights are respected, there couldn't be fractional reserve banking. Because Rothbard, as I'm sure most of you know, thinks that fractional reserve banking, it's not merely that he thinks in practice it would be unprofitable and wouldn't be an outcome on the free market. He thinks that inherently, by its very nature, it's fraudulent. And so if a commercial bank is engaged in fractional reserve banking, Rothbard thinks it's defrauding its customers, and in that respect, it's like stealing their property. So since, by definition, a purely free market is one in which property rights are respected, you can't have fractional reserve banking in such a world. And so if Rothbard defines inflation, meaning an increase in the total quantity of money over and above the increase in the specie, the hard metal backing it up, then if there's no fractional reserve banking, there can't be any inflation. And so there's no inflation, and then because he thinks the Austrian boom-bust cycle is driven by an inflationary boom, that also means that by definition there can't be a business cycle in a free market. All right, so those are all some very interesting implications of Rothbard's definition. So in particular, Rothbard does not care about what happens to the demand for money. He's saying if the commercial banks inflate and they start issuing fiduciary media, so granting demand deposits more than what is backed up by the gold or whatever the commodity money is that has been brought in and put on deposit and is sitting in their vaults, then that sets in motion an inflationary boom and pushing down the interest rate below what it ought to be, misleading entrepreneurs, making them start unsustainable projects that then must necessarily collapse. Now, in practice, you know, you could have a boom that's not a big deal, but or you could have a really awful one. But the point is, Rothbard is saying that I don't need any more information. If the commercial banks are granting more loans than they have deposits of hard money backing it up in the vaults, then that sets in motion the boom-bust cycle that, you know, Mises and Hayek talked about. I don't care what the community's demand for money is. So you can't say, oh, well, no, it's offset because the community wanted to hold more money, and this was more efficient than having to go dig up more gold. And we're robbing them out, that's not it. So both of, that's an interesting implication of his worldview, whereas with Mises, at least the definitions offered in that one appendix that we, you know, that I forget which chapter it is, but it's in the Theory of Money and Credit, it would look like that's not, it would, how do I put it? Okay, so for one thing, you could have fractional reserve banking and no boom bust cycle because you wouldn't have inflation. That so long as the banks only expanded or contracted their issuing of fiduciary media to offset or to accommodate changes in the public's demand to hold money, then that wouldn't be an issue. And I'm trying to think, does it go the other way? Could you still have a boom-bust cycle on the free market? I mean, I guess, I mean, you could, you can't rule it out by definition, whereas under Rothbard, you could rule it out by definition, but so long as you thought that the commercial banks would be led by the invisible hand to only issue fiduciary media because of changes in the public's demand to hold money, then you wouldn't expect, there wouldn't be a boom bust cycle. I'd have to think about that more, but I'm pretty sure that's right. All right, so both parties would think that the free market wouldn't have it, but Rothbard would say that, like, almost by definition they can't have it, whereas the free bankers would have to say, you know, and make a sort of market process argument for why the incentives would be such that we wouldn't expect it to happen, something like that. But the problem is, who asked me that, Lewis? I'm hesitant to just say that there's this big difference between Mises' definition and Rothbard's because, like I said, there's plenty of places in Theory of Money and Credit and more so in Human Action where Mises does seem to say that issuing fiduciary media by itself sets in motion the unsustainable boom. Right? So it doesn't seem like Mises always just means issuing fiduciary media above and beyond the public's increase in the demand to hold money. And so it's hard to figure out what exactly is Mises' position. So it is, so again, he clearly does say if you as an economist want a technical definition of inflation and deflation, these are the only definitions that are coherent. But I was talking to Joe Salerno about this. So let me just give you a little bit of the context, Lewis. So why did it come? I don't remember, but for some reason, Joe Salerno had a thing on the Mises blog within the last 3 months, let's say, talking about this very issue. And Joe said something like, I don't understand why everyone keeps putting so much weight on this one thing that Mises wrote in the Theory of Money and Credit in an appendix to one chapter. When, you know, there's all this stuff he says in Human Action, and Salerno says that actually Mises thinks that the terms inflation and deflation are really not very useful for the economist, that they don't have a very good technical meaning. And Joe, you know, produces passages from Human Action where Mises says something like that. So Joe's take was, Mises just changed his mind. So yeah, the free bankers and whatever, if you want to put a bunch of weight on something that the young Mises wrote in 1912, okay, but by the time he was mature and wrote Human Action, look at his views had changed, and he was much more of a Rothbardian at that point in his career. So, you know, that's a feather in our cap, right? That Mises used to think like you guys, and then as he got older, he changed his mind. So clearly, Mises rejected your viewpoint, and he adopted Rothbard. That was Salerno's take on it. But I, you know, went and looked back at the that appendix in Theory of Money and Credit, that part where he gives those definitions. And I wrote to Joe, and I said, Joe, I think you're actually conceding too much. Go look again at his actual words in the Theory of Money and Credit. Mises is only very reluctantly giving those definitions, right, where Mises says inflation refers to an increase in the supply of money over and above the demand, which therefore reduces the purchasing power of the monetary unit. It's not like Mises just says, here's the precise definition, learn it, live it, love it. No, I mean, I forget his exact words, but he says something like, you know, in the political debate, people throw the terms around inflation, deflation. As economists, we like to have very precise technical words. If we had to, we would, to define those terms as economists, we would say such and such. But, and then he even says something like, it would be inappropriate for the economist to pedantically chastise, you know, the partisans in these political debates with our own definition because, you know, it can be misleading to apply it in certain contexts or something. I mean, I'm not giving him, obviously I'm paraphrasing, but that was the way he said it even there. So my point to Joe was, it's not like Mises was giving a full-throated defense of these definitions, the Theory of Money and Credit, and then decades later kind of changed his mind. It's actually, those terms are so loosey-goosey, it's not really appropriate. I mean, even back then, Mises is kind of saying, these aren't really great definitions because these terms are so vague, but if you're putting a gun to my head, this is the way I would define it. All right, obviously I'm exaggerating and say put a gun to my head, but so Lewis, it's I'm sort of dodging your question because I'm not sure. I think I guess if I have to pick, I like Rothbard's definition because I think that's crisper and it makes more sense. And you know, I don't see what's wrong with just saying, yeah, there's inflation of the money stock, but the public demand to hold money went up even more, and so that's why prices fell. To me, that sounds fine to say that. So because I'm very so – anyway, I'm just repeating myself. So if I have to pick – but my point is the reason I went on that long tangent there is I wanted to be clear that I don't think there's actually this huge chasm between Mises' view and Rothbard's. I think Rothbard had a very crisp definition of what inflation was that coincided with his views on other things so that he could get the answer, inflation is bad. And Mises, on the other hand, throughout his career, I think, didn't really think that those terms were economic terms. He thought that they were stuff that partisans and political battles used, but that they weren't very good technical terms for economic science per se. Okay. Steve Chipman says, what is your opinion of Peter Schiff's view about the inevitability of high inflation in the future? I haven't been keeping tabs too much with what Peter Schiff has been saying. Yeah, but if you're just asking me what do I think, yeah, I've been, as some of you may know, I have been on the bandwagon of warning about a fall in the dollar's purchasing power because of the stuff Bernanke's been doing. And thus far, my warnings have been premature or exaggerated. Okay, so because people were coming back. So I never said, oh, there's going to be hyperinflation in the next 2 years. All right, I even was publicly critical of, I think it was Mark, was it Faber? Is that how you say his name? I think he was out there running around comparing the U.S. to Zimbabwe a couple of years ago. And I was saying, I think that's a mistake because I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. And I think you're just kind of going to discredit what we're saying if you're saying it like that. But then people were coming back to me and said, okay, then what do you think? And so I was making predictions about what would happen to the official CPI, and I was wrong, right? That in other words, I thought it would be increasing at a faster annual rate by now, than it has been. And I know the Bureau of Labor and Statistics has all kinds of tricks to minimize it and everything, but I was saying, even adjusting for that, I think that it's going to be so big, they're not going to be able to suppress it. That they're not going to be able to straight face to say there's 2% CPI increase if the real number is 27% or something. So anyway, so I'm just giving it all these caveats to say I've been either premature or totally wrong, depending on your perspective so far. So I still think that's going to happen. I think there's a few mitigating factors that, as we mentioned already, the normal process by which excess reserves get lent out and increase the quantity of money that's held by the general public, that has been short-circuited because of all these crazy things going on. Banks' balance sheets are really bad. Interest rates across the board are very low, and so an individual bank is going to say, well, why would I make a loan to a business person? Why don't I just go park it in treasuries? You know, the environment's so bleak. So there's that kind of issue. And then also, because the Eurozone is in serious crisis, that I think has artificially propped up the dollar. So I think if the rest of the world were normal and the U.S. were in its current situation with what Bernanke's been doing, you would have already seen a massive flight from the dollar, and you would see commodity prices even higher than they are, and that would be feeding into all sorts of other price hikes. So I think there's been a few things that have sort of masked the most extreme consequences of what Bernanke has done so far, but it just, in my opinion, bought us time. It's not that it would totally override what he did. So in other words, those excess reserves are still sitting there. The fact that they haven't been lent out yet doesn't mean the danger is gone. It just means it's like a loaded gun that hasn't been, the trigger hasn't been pulled yet. So what I will say, people will ask me and they say, okay, well, Murphy, then, you know, you've been wrong so far that price inflation hasn't been as high as you thought. So what would make you admit that you're just totally wrong? And I said, okay, what would make me admit that I totally missed the boat on this stuff is, if the U.S. economy gradually recovers and then the Fed starts gradually raising interest rates and unwinds its balance sheet, you know, it starts either explicitly selling off its assets or just letting them mature and then not rolling it over. Right? So as people pay off the principal, that would also reduce the Fed assets out of the Fed's balance sheet because those, you know, reserves just disappear. And so if the Fed just let things naturally unwind and it goes back to having a balance sheet and you can adjust it for, you know, relative to GDP or something, whatever you want to do, that it had like in 2007, and we haven't had a clearly disruptive burst of price inflation, then I will admit, okay, yeah, I totally missed this, and, you know, Scott Sumner or Paul Krugman were a much better guide through this thing than I was, at least with respect to monetary policy. But so far, that's, the Fed keeps increasing its balance sheet. So far, it hasn't come anywhere near putting me in the awkward position of having that bluff called, as it were. The other thing, too, let me just say, it's not like, I mean, Paul Krugman keeps running victory laps, saying, I told you guys, these idiot free market guys kept worrying about hyperinflation, and I kept saying, no, because we have a liquidity trap and high unemployment and arid demand, blah, 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 so you're not going to have big prices, and I've been so right, and what better test of ISLM, old school Keynesian analysis could we possibly want? If you're empirical at all, clearly you have to think I'm the best economist and these guys are all idiots, and why would you ever listen to them again? He's been saying that nonstop for the last 18 months. But the thing is, so it's true, prices have not risen as quickly as I warned and probably Peter Schiff and some other guys. But Krugman kept warning about deflation, by which he meant falling prices. And he kept saying how when high unemployment wages can't rise and stuff like that. And it's not like we've had falling prices. Prices have been rising, even if we look at their preferred metrics like core CPI, which is, you know, the consumer price index with food and energy taken out, which is a stupid thing to begin with. But even looking at that, that's been rising, and in fact is rising above the Fed's official comfort zone, right? The Fed says it wants core CPI to be between 1% and 2%, and the last numbers I looked at, it was 2.3% or something like that. So the point is, even with unemployment being real high and the so-called output gap and all this other stuff, the official price inflation measures are just about all above where they should be. So it's true they're not at 10%, the official ones, but they are above where they ought to be. So if we were in a normal economy right now, the Fed should be raising interest rates because price inflation is running too high. And so that should be impossible, according to Krugman's worldview. Krugman was saying we were going to have very modest price pressure or even deflation, that we were in danger of prices falling, as if that would be a bad thing. And yet prices are rising more quickly than the Fed wants them to, even though we simultaneously have high unemployment and a so-called output gap. So, Krugman is just full of it when he's making it look like this is unfolding exactly as he forecast. No, it isn't. What is happening right now should be impossible according to his paradigm. And he keeps coming up with ad hoc, it's because there's a spike in commodity prices. But once that gets in, why did commodity prices go up? How come they didn't go down? So my point is that, yeah, there are a lot of things, and it's true. I think the actual price inflation is much higher than the government statistics indicate. But I'm saying even on their own terms, even if we took the government statistics as gospel, price inflation now is higher than the Fed's official targets. And so when Krugman is saying how he's been so right on this, no, he hasn't. Okay, Gilberto Rodriguez gives some good YouTube links to stuff that the Ron Paul's office put out about money. So people want to look at that, go ahead. Let's see. We got about 7 minutes left if you guys have any more questions. CB says, there's been steady inflation the past year and a half. Milk is up. Portion sizes at restaurants are smaller. Candy bars at Walmart cost more, 50 to 75 cents, etc. And it's continuing this year. There's inflation across the board for stuff people buy every day. Yeah, that's true. And this is partly, CB, why this is partly why I think the BLS is vastly understating the actual increase in consumer prices, because what you have right now in the last few years is households that are under a lot of pressure, right? They have high debt, and their income has dried up for a lot of them, or even if they still have a job, they're terrified that they might lose it. So everybody, normal household, are being extremely careful on how they spend money. They're being very price conscious. So producers now, they've seen their input prices go way up, and their commodities have been going up. So if you look at the official price indices, and I would do this for a while, I was doing it every month, the higher you went in the food chain, as it were, the further you got away from the consumer good. And the more you went up in terms of the producer price. So the prices of crude goods would be up like 20% year over year, and then the prices of intermediate goods would be up 15%, and the prices of finished producer goods would be up 10%, and then the price of consumer goods would be up 3.6%, and the price of consumer goods less food and energy would be up 1.8%. I mean, I'm obviously making up those numbers, but it was like that. So the point was, the one class of goods that the Keynesians would look at was the one thing where the numbers weren't too big, but if you look at the prices that producers had to pay for their inputs, they were through the roof. And so you say, okay, what happens in an environment like that? How can it be you know, how can firms stay in business if their input prices are going up 20% over a year? What do? They can't just pass it along to the consumer because then the consumer is not going to buy the product. And so they cut corners. They do all kinds of stuff. So, for example, and this is something that Silas Barta first pointed out, and then I went to mention it. I was seeing it all over the place. Things like toilet paper. It's a lot thinner now, right? The rolls of the standard, whatever your brand of toilet paper used to be, and you think you're still buying the jumbo roll or whatever with the big bear on the front cover who, you know, this lovable and furry and the kind of guy you want in the bathroom with when you're doing your business. Those, they used to be thicker, like the actual sheets, and now they're not. And cereal boxes, the actual cardboard of the box itself is thinner now than it used to be. It's flimsier. And I think we just kind of, you know, you might, if you don't believe me and you go to look at it, you might say, no, this is how I do it. No, I'm telling you, it's a lot, you know, you could more easily rip your Cheerios box in half than you could have 5 years ago. So because the price of all these inputs is going up, clearly the manufacturers are trying to figure out ways to give an inferior product to the customer without having to jack up the unit price as much. And as CB mentioned, other tricks too are to like reduce the quantities. So you're actually, I mean, stuff like you go buy, I mean, I was in Subway recently and I picked up a bag of, you know, you get the meal deal, you get your 6-inch sub and a drink and a bag of chips. And the bag of chips had like 5 chips in it or something. And I mean, yeah, they always jip you like that, but it was never, I mean, it was absurd. Whereas 5 years ago, clearly there were more potato chips in the bag of chips that you would get at Subway than there are now. So just little things like that. So I don't trust that the statisticians working for the Bureau of Labor and Statistics are correctly accounting for that. So when they say, oh no, the price of toilet paper has only gone up 1.3% in the last year or whatever the number is, I don't think they're adjusting for the fact that now it's 2-ply instead of 4-ply or whatever. And when they say, oh, the price of a bag of potato chips has only gone up 6.2%, I don't think they're adjusting for the fact that you get 20% fewer chips in there or whatever the numbers are. So I think that's a lot of what's going on too. Okay, Connor O'Neill says, doesn't China pegging the yuan to the dollar hurt their currency in the long run? Because to peg it, they have to print more of their currency, so won't that eventually inflate their currency, or do they get around this somehow? You're exactly right. So so what happens, and this is what's funny with all the people arguing about China, and people are simultaneously mad that the Chinese government is, quote, undervaluing its currency, keeping its currency weaker against the dollar than it should be, and they're mad that China might not be buying as much of our treasuries as they used to. And those are, you can't be mad at both of those things. What's happening is the Chinese government is pegging its currency to the dollar. I think it's actually been letting it appreciate recently, but in general, they were pegging their currency to the dollar. And the way they maintain that peg is if their currency is supposed to appreciate, other things equal, based on trade flows, then the Chinese government would take yuan, go buy dollars with it, and then use the dollars to buy U.S. treasuries. And that was how they were maintaining the peg. And so if you want the Chinese government to stop maintaining that peg and to let its currency appreciate against the dollar, the only way they can do that is if they stop buying so many U.S. treasuries. So, but you're right, Connor. If they're doing that and the Fed comes in and starts pumping out massive amounts of new dollars, the way the Chinese central bank and government would typically respond to that is they would print up a lot more yuan. And then they would use it to go buy treasuries. And so that's how they would maintain their peg. So when people say, for example, oh, how could Alan Greenspan be responsible for the housing boom like those Austrians claim, because the boom the housing boom was a worldwide phenomenon. Part of the explanation, I think, is that if the Fed starts inflating and other central banks just stay put, then their currencies are going to strengthen against the dollar a lot. And that's going to hurt their exports, at least in the short run. And so then they're going to have a lot of political pressure. So when the Fed starts inflating like crazy, certainly China, if it has an explicit peg, but even other countries that don't have a technical peg, but they don't want their currency to strengthen 20% against the dollar per year, because that's really going to hurt their exports in the short run, then they have an incentive to inflate just to not have their exports get crushed. And so yeah, I still do think it's Greenspan's fault there was a worldwide housing bubble. Okay, I think we got to stop there. CB, you have a question there about oil. If you're dying to know the answer, if you post it in the, what are we now, in week six? If you post it there in the questions for the professor, I'll get to that. But right now I got to stop. Okay, thanks for tuning in, everybody. And we'll see you next time.